EFT Houston. We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
Hello, everybody. This is Queer Voices, a podcast and radio show on KPFT 90.1 FM that's been on the air for several decades as one of the oldest LGBTQ+ radio shows in the southern United States. Today's episode is a packed one with three diverse interviews featuring author of American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era, Nico Lang, as well as award-winning playwrights behind the upcoming conversion therapy musical, The Chosen Ones, Aaron Alon, and writer, director, and producer, Wayne Chella. Normally, we'd play snippets of each interview as a preview, but this episode is packed from start to finish. So let's dive right into contributor Ethan Michelle Ganz's interview with author of American Teenager, Nico Lang.
This is Queer Voices, and this is Ethan Michelle Ganz. We're talking to Nico Lang today, who is the author of a book called American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. Lang is the founder of Queer News Daily and an award-winning journalist. So, Nico Lang, how are you doing today?
I'm all right. I'm hanging out with a cat in Youngstown, Ohio, so life could be a lot worse.
Tell me a little bit about what inspired you to write this book.
Yeah, well, you know, it was a number of different things, but I think one of the big things for me is that I knew I had the resources to write it. Like, I've known a lot of these families because, you know, for the uninitiated, I spent a year traveling the country to document the lives of trans kids in seven different states. And a lot of those families I already knew because I've been doing this work for a long time, and I'm a longtime LGBTQ+ journalist. I've written for more places than I haven't. And I just knew that I had the trust of families to be able to write something like this, because a lot of these families, they knew me, they've met me, they've spent time with me, they like me. And with that, I thought that gave me a certain level of responsibility, because I could write a book that I knew very few journalists were positioned to do, meant to do it in a way that really like uplifted and celebrated the community during a really tough time. So I just felt like almost in a way I had no choice. Of course I did, but like, what was I going to do? Not do it? Was I going to like not help these kids like speak their truth during a time in which they're being erased? No, like I was just going to do it.
What was the most impactful interaction you think you had while writing the book?
God, that's very Sophie's Choice of us, isn't it? Well, yeah. Well, I can't choose between my children. But I will say that I think that the story that resonated with me, like in a, not the most because they all really resonated with me, but in a really like personal way, was the Jack and Augie story in Florida. Because for those who haven't read the book yet, they were trans siblings in Pensacola, Florida. And their mom is a survivor of domestic violence. They had recently been homeless for 3 months. And Jack had been detransitioned by the state of Florida when she lost her gender-affirming care under Medicaid. So the family was like really, really going through a lot at the time that I got there. They were really traumatized, for lack of a better word. You could almost like see the trauma in their bodies like a second skin. And that was really hard. It was hard to be there with them sometimes. It was hard to be with people who were in really severe pain and struggling. But also, I related to them so much. They reminded me so much of my childhood. Like, I grew up really poor, and my mom was a single mom who was often, like, struggling economically and struggling with mental health issues, and also a survivor of domestic violence. And getting to tell a story like that, that was close to my experience in so many ways, just felt really, really important to me. I was really grateful that they were courageous enough to, like, let people in during that time. Because I think it takes a lot of vulnerability to do that. to let this person that you barely know stay in your house for 2.5 weeks. And then on top of that, like, all these people that you don't know are going to be reading out about your story, you know, people that you'll never meet, making up all the, you know, whatever kind of opinions they want about you. And the idea that they were still willing to do that and to give us the gift of their story, it's just such a tremendous present. Like, I really am truly in awe of them for doing this with me, and just deeply grateful forever. I'll be grateful for the rest of my life.
Yeah, it does seem like a really great project. And it seems like it would have been a lot of fun.
Sometimes it was a lot. It was like every emotion. It was like being hooked up to a car battery of emotion for like a year. We'll just say I used to be one of those people who like looked at a boring day and was just like sort of dreaded it. And now I'm like, oh my God, an hour of quiet. Doesn't that sound great? Like where I am right now, it's like sort of like, it outside sounds a little country, even though it's in the city. It's very almost like cricket sort of thing. And I'm like, oh my God, just a minute of peace. It's great.
So did you learn anything interesting that you didn't know that you would learn while you were writing this book?
I always feel like such a cop-out when I say this, but no, because I've been doing this work for such a long time. Like, you know, I've worked with families of trans kids for so long that I feel like anything I was going to learn, I already learned. You know, it wasn't really about what I needed to learn. It's more about what readers need to learn. But I think something I'd kind of not forgotten necessarily, because, you know, I'm a person on the surf, but, you know, I'm not dumb. But I think I needed to be reminded of once again is how hard it is to be a kid already. Like, being a teenager is tough, man. And I just haven't been a teenager in such a long time that I just didn't have any muscle memory of it anymore. Like that, the kids that you go to school with, right? You don't choose these kids and you're just stuck in class with them. And sometimes you like them and you get along. And sometimes they're the most evil little brats on the planet, you know, and you just have to put up with them. And so much of the drama in these kids' lives, you know, the kids who are in the book, was based around school, was just based around the sort of like daily sociality of the whole thing, of who's fighting with whom, you know, who's on the outs with whom, who's dating whom, who's cheating on whom, you know, just all of this, like this interpersonal stuff. And being connected again to like the real experience of like what it's like to be a teen and not what we project onto teenagers. It really brought back some memories. Like it really forced me to really relive a lot of my childhood and just remembering what it was like. It was a very immersive experience for me emotionally. And I think it's also a reminder for all of us adults that these kids are already dealing with a lot. You know, it's like, they're dealing with being teenagers and trying to figure out their like path in life and what they're going to do and what college they're going to go to and trying to make the most of all this while they still can, that like they need time to do that. And putting all this like this stuff on them, like anti-trans legislation and having to fight for their rights, like, and do all of this like activism work, it's just so exhausting. Like, it's incredible that they do it. Like, there are so many trans kids who are amazing activists and who are really doing the work, and we're all like, I'm so grateful to them. I'm in awe of them. But they also just shouldn't have to. Like, you know, being a teen is hard enough. They shouldn't have to be fighting all these battles on top of it. So I just hope at some point they just don't have to anymore, that we get to a point in society where we just let these kids live their lives, let them be kids, leave them alone. It's not like people who are affirming them that are taking away their childhoods or something like that. It's the people who are trying to strip away their rights, who are giving them no choice but to fight all the time. So I just hope that at some point they get to be that. They get to just enjoy this little sliver of teenagedom while it lasts, because the thing is, it doesn't last forever. You got to enjoy it while you can.
Well, that's the truth. Nothing lasts forever. So what do you hope that the readers learn and get from this book?
I mean, it's sad and kind of basic, but I hope they learn to treat these kids like human beings. Like, I just feel like we have a way of treating trans kids, and not we like allies or, you know, or queer people, but people on the other side of this have a way of treating these kids like they're like sea creatures who were recently discovered at the bottom of the ocean. You know, just the entire rhetoric around them is so dehumanizing. This conversation is so dehumanizing. And they feel it too. They feel just like constantly othered. It's a horrible feeling, and it's very like lonely making. So for people reading the book, I hope they realize that these, You know, these people are just kids, but at the same time, they're also human beings who deserve the same rights as the rest of us. And it's really pathetic that there needs to be a book that exists that explains that to people, that, you know, these kids are human beings who deserve the same rights as they do. But here we are, you know, and I hope people take that away. I hope people look at these kids expressing their voices and their thoughts and their opinions and their own agency, and they realize that they deserve that, that they deserve to define their path in life however they want. Because I do think that these kids maybe taught me one thing, not to contradict myself from before. And again, it's something I kind of already knew, but sometimes I'm dumb and I need to be reminded of things. That in the marriage equality movement, like circa, like 2007, 2008, and all the way to 2015, right? The kind of dominant message of the movement then was that we deserve rights because we're the same as you. You know, like our love is the same. Our hearts are the same. Our lives are the same. So give us rights because we're just like you. And, you know, I don't want to drag that too much because clearly it was effective. It worked. But like, with all due respect, I don't think that's what these kids have ever been fighting for. And I don't think that's what I've been fighting for either. Like, I don't deserve rights because I'm just like someone else. I deserve rights because I'm me. And it's the same for these kids. Like, they deserve rights because they are them and they are Americans who are entitled to the same inalienable rights as everyone else. I think that we're in this point right now in America where we're just so scared of difference. We're so scared of people who are different from us or have different lives than us or different paths. And it's kind of always been like that, right? You look at like we used to own people in this country because they were different from us, and that difference made them less human. So I just hope that at some point in this country, we're finally able to look at difference as being our strength, that we don't all have to be the same to be like beautiful, that in fact, it's the ways in which we're not like each other that can make us the most beautiful. It's what makes this country strong.
So did you ever think when you were a kid growing up that you would end up doing a project like this?
No, I was really poor. I didn't have any connections. Like, all my friends in college, like, I started out in a journalism program, right? But I didn't last in it because it's like every time I would ask somebody how they got this like, oh, cushy internship, it would always be like, oh, my dad made a call, you know? And I just didn't know how I was ever going to get anywhere because it's like, my dad isn't going to make a call to anybody. You know what I mean? Like, I just like my mom, it's like the guy she can make a call to are like biker gangs. You know, there's just nobody in my networks that I could like leverage to make something like this happen for myself. It was just like a lot of like determination and stubbornness on my part and just being really good. So I never thought that I would get a shot like this. I never thought that anyone would ever open a door for me. And the fact is that not a lot of people did. I think there were definitely people who helped me here and there, but for the most part, people seemed very inclined to keeping those doors locked. So I had to like not just like look for a window, I had to bust the walls down. And I feel like I'm still doing that. It's why I've been, you know, to 38 states on this book tour, you know, 92 stops, because I was told while shopping this book around that there was no audience for it, that there was no market for it. And almost no publishers would pick this up because they didn't think they could sell it. And I'm just, again, a very stubborn person that I've got to prove to the industry and also to myself that there is an audience for this book. People do want this. People do care. And I will keep touring this country for as long as I have to do that until I drop dead or they make it literally illegal to tour books. I will still be doing this. Just call me Willie Loman, you know?
What's next for you now that you've done this big project?
I do a lot of sleeping right now. So that's part of pretty much like number one on my like priority list. I'm going to be touring this book for as long as I can. My hope is to have the longest book tour in history because I just, that point I was talking about before of wanting to prove to the industry that there is an audience for this, there's a community here and stuff like this can sell. Like, I feel like I have to make that point in the clearest possible way. And even if it's like a couple years of my life that it'll take to make this point, I've got to just do it. But then after that, I'm working on a secret project that I won't talk about because I don't want anyone to steal the idea. But the thing that no one's going to steal because, you know, you're not related to her, is I'm writing a biography of my great-grandmother who was like an early Hollywood like dancer and like flapper who led this like absolutely fabulous wild life. She was like a Black woman who passed herself off as Turkish in order to have a career in the 1940s at a time in which, you know, not only like women were being still forced into the home, but on top of that, like Black women especially, there was just such little opportunity. And she just managed to have all of these incredible experiences and just this, I know this word is slightly problematic, but like this, like just like crazy stuff that she was able to do, right? At a time in which people were told they couldn't have that. I just think is so incredible and profound. Like I only learned about my great grandmother's existence last year through the wonders of 23andMe. And I never really had a role model before. Like I remember as a kid, we had to do this project in school where we created our own Wheaties box. And I had to like figure out who my role model would be for, you know, to put on the Wheaties box. And I had no idea. Like I looked at the adults in my life and it's like, you're all lovely, but I don't want your lives. Like I don't aspire to be you. And there wasn't anybody I saw like out in the world that just felt like, oh, I want what you have. I believe I ended up picking Carrie Strug, who was just like a gymnast at the time, who'd like, you know, like won some Olympic medals, right? So it was just like, I don't know, whatever. And now all these years later, for the first time in my life, I feel like I have a role model and that feels cool. This little like, you know, Black bisexual, like chaos demon who is just like wreaking havoc in Southern California. That feels deeply relatable to me. And I love that. And I cannot wait.
Well, I'm sure the listeners will be excited to see that when it comes out. So tell me, is there anything that you would want people to know that I haven't asked you about or any information you want people to not to have?
Support your local bookstore. Go see a movie. I'm a big advocate for the cinema and it's dying right now. Go see Weapons. It's really great. And just be good to each other. Like we're at this point in society where there's just so much like cruelty and evilness, for like lack of a better word. It's kind of a cliche thought, but I think that kindness will save us. I think that listening to other people's stories will save us. Being a better person like is what transforms this, like forms our culture. There's this idea of like jihad in Islam is often like misunderstood. Like all it means really is transformation. And there's this idea of like the transformation of the self and the transformation of society. And through transforming the self, you know, we transform society. So I hope all of us are able to do that internal work so we can create a better world, not just for these kids who deserve to grow up in an America that doesn't victimize them all the time, but so that way we create a better America for all of us. I think we all deserve that.
Agreed. So thank you very much for spending time with me and talking with us today. We really appreciate that. This has been Queer Voices, and I'm Ethan Michelle Gans. We've been talking to Nico Lang, the writer, the author of American Teenager, How Trans Kids Are Surviving Hate and Finding Joy in a Turbulent Era. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi there, it's Brett Cullum, and I am here with Aaron Alon of Thunderclap Productions. They are going to be presenting the world premiere of The Chosen Ones, which is a riveting new musical by, well, Aaron Alon. So there we go. It's described as heart-wrenching, hilarious, ultimately unforgettable. It follows a group of LGBTQIA plus teens in conversion therapy summer camp, which sounds like a lot of fun. And it's all led by an ex-gay minister. And it's a timely story of living authentically, finding your chosen family, even when the world tells you not to. So this is part of a series of shows that the Thunderclap Productions has done. It's part of the John Stephen Kellett Memorial Series. And it's all about LGBTQ plus equity productions addressing that. Performances will be at the Match in Matchbox 3, August 28th through September 6th. So welcome, Aaron. Thank you for talking to me.
It's a pleasure to be here, Brett. Thank you.
You know, it's interesting. I think conversion therapy, I just read Boy Interrupted and looked at the movie version of it and all that kind of stuff. Wait, it's not Boy Interrupted. What is that?
I know which one you're thinking of. Yeah, it's, it'll come to me in a second. Hold on, I'll look it up.
Boy Erased.
Yeah.
Girl Interrupted is the Angelina Jolie thing.
Yeah.
And I always want to call it that. Boy Erased, though. It's a book, Gerard Conley, and a movie, obviously, that was made and all about conversion therapy. So what made you want to write a musical about conversion therapy?
Yeah, you know, I had written two large-scale musicals, and they're incredibly exciting to write when you write a really big show, you know, like 40 person cast, 9 person pit orchestra kind of shows. I'm very proud of those shows, but very hard to get those sorts of shows put on. So I wanted to focus on a small scale show where I could tell a more intimate story. And I started, oftentimes what I do with shows is I think about sort of what topics are interesting. I tend to be kind of an issue driven writer a lot of times. So I thought about what's the topic that I think is really important and that sort of close to my heart. And I started thinking a little bit about conversion therapy. I had been a volunteer for about 9 years with Hatch, which is a LGBTQ plus support group for queer teens in the Houston area. I was with them for about 9 years. And, you know, I saw a lot of kids struggling and who had gone through those programs and whose parents were threatening to send them to those programs. Even one kid who told his mom he was going to conversion therapy so he could attend Hatch.
Of course.
So, you know, it just, and I realize that this is a subject that I feel like we've stopped talking about, even though it's still a really, really big deal. You know, the big national organization, Exodus One, that had been over this, dissolved. And that's a really interesting story, actually, about how that ended. And they had so much more presence in the media, I think, when there was this big national group over it. And it's sort of when they dissolved, it sort of fragmented into all these different pieces. And so we don't know how many conversion therapy camps there are. We don't know where there are, how many there are. There's no licensure. Some states have banned the practice for kids, but it's still legal in a majority of the U.S. states.
Including here.
Including here, yeah. And in fact, I even was looking at some of the like Republican platforms for Texas, and I found it explicitly endorsed in one of the past Republican state platforms for the state of Texas. They said, you know, we support a version of conversion therapy that they had mentioned there. And historically, they had done that a number of times, and they just kind of use whatever the latest trend is for something that is conversion therapy but has a different name. So anyhow, I care about this issue, and I thought this could be a story worth telling, and I do what I do in a lot of shows. I spent about a year just digging into research and learning all I can. I interviewed survivors of conversion therapy. I read different testimonials that people had put out there about their experiences with it. I tried to learn about the people who were like high level on the other side too, people who were supporting conversion therapy and creating versions of conversion therapy, and how did they justify it, and how do they try to make it sound rigorous and scientific. And yeah, and so through that process, I developed this original story about 6 queer kids in this camp who are all there under different circumstances and all have their different stories, but what this one summer means to them when they all come together in this one place.
So it's really about their relationships and bonding, kind of trauma bonding, if you will, over this experience.
I definitely think that's a big part of it. So, you know, part of it is showing what conversion therapy looks like. And honestly, it's one of the nicer versions of conversion therapy. These are all people who really care about kids. They think they're doing good in the world. You know, they're trying to do something that they think is loving and helpful with these kids. There are a lot worse versions of conversion therapy than that. So I tried to give it its, to show that even in its best forms, it's incredibly dangerous and scary. And, but so one part of the story is about conversion therapy. The other part is what happens with these 6 kids. 5 of the 6 kids do not want to be there.
Of course.
Yeah. There is one kid of the 6 though, who actually had to talk his parents into letting him go there. And interestingly, as I've talked to different people working through this project, I've met a few of the adults who were once that kid. The kid who was so upset about being gay, very religious, really wanted to, as they say, pray the gay away, and opted to go into a place like this, desperate for help. So there's both of those sides are represented in this. And there are different types of kids here too. There are lesbians, gay boys, there's a pansexual teen, there's a trans teen. So like I'm trying to, even in this small group, show this idea. This is a huge camp. These are 6 kids that they chose to put together into one small group. Who are they? How do they come together? In what ways do they support each other, scare each other, challenge each other, help each other, all of that stuff?
Well, you mentioned Exodus a little bit earlier, and they used to run the big Love in Action group out of Memphis, Tennessee. And I had some interaction with them as a young man. My parents were very interested in me going to that, but they will not accept you unless, or back in those days, they would not accept you unless you specifically wanted to be there. I mean, they absolutely were like, you know, if you're going to buck us, you know, move on to the next thing. So it's interesting. You've got this kind of dynamic going on that you've got five, obviously, that are kind of not super happy to be there. But I think there is kind of a desperation whenever you end up in a conversion camp.
Yeah, it just happens.
How did you go about casting this? I mean, obviously, it's a sensitive subject, and it looks like you've got a great cast assembled for it.
Truly great cast. Yeah, we have a wonderful cast and also great leadership at the helm. Aisha Asuri is directing and choreographing it. Philip D. Hall is the music director. Our production team is also incredible. We've been really very thoughtful about how we put together this group of performers and this production team. We actually had multiple rounds of auditions. Now, about a year before this even, I put out a recording of The Chosen Ones. So I, through my own personal production company, I cast and released a recording of all the songs in the show. Three of the original six performers from there are now in this.
Good.
Originating the roles that they sang on the recording. The other five actors are new to the project. And we had multiple rounds of auditions. You know, in some cases, it was immediately clear, wow, this person's going to be amazing. In some cases, we wanted to see more people and wanted to see more people until we really found someone where we were like, yes, this is the person who will match with this role in this cast. And the group of people we've put together, again, is just truly remarkable. And we're so excited to see them bring it to life.
Well, speaking of the recording, is there a way that you can go in and listen to that?
Absolutely. So if anyone wants to just visit thechosenonesmusical.com and click on music and video, I have links there to all of the streaming services where it's available. So it's available on all the standard ones, you know, Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Pandora. And yeah, if they have access to any of those streaming services, Spotify is a great way to get it for free. Some of the other ones require subscriptions and stuff like that. We're gradually creating videos and putting those videos out on YouTube too. So there are currently, I think, two studio recordings out, one of a song called The Secret of Makeup and one of a song called Joseph Joe, where people can like watch them singing in a studio setting kind of thing and hear the songs in that context too.
Now, if I've got this right, you did the music, you did the lyrics, you wrote the book, and you did the orchestra.
That's right, yeah.
When did you realize that you were this like musical person that could construct and create a whole thing, like one-man band kind of style? I mean, that's very rare.
You know, and it depends on the project that I'm working on too. So I started as a classical composer. I got 3 degrees in classical composition. In fact, that's what brought me to Houston originally, was to complete my doctorate at the Rice University Shepherd School of Music in composition. So I did a lot of training in classical composition, which of course includes things like orchestration. And then basically as soon as I finished my degrees, I realized I don't really love writing classical music. There are other things I'm more passionate about. And I went to earlier passions of writing plays and musicals. That was around 2009. I started writing some short plays that did really well in like the competition circuit. And they were performed around the country in New York and Houston and stuff like that. And these are little plays, like 10-minute plays, but it improved me as a writer. I collaborated with someone else on a new musical where they wrote lyrics and I wrote music. And I was not a good lyricist at this point, but I was a really good editor. And it was sort of a masterclass when I worked with this really great lyricist where he'd write lyrics, I'd send back feedback, and I'd watch how he would make revisions. And that process created stronger songs for our show that we were working on, which was never finished, but it was still we produced some really beautiful work, I think. But it also helped me grow. So, and I'd been involved with theater since I was a little kid. And so just long time passion of theater and musical theater. And then I started writing my own musicals and coordinated a musical review, a comedic musical review called Death the Musical, helped co-found a theater company here, Thunderclap Productions, which is, you know, still going strong, and started writing additional shows. And, you know, the way that I grow and become stronger at the areas where I'm weaker is partially by doing, but largely by just sharing my work with other really talented people and getting feedback and doing the same for them. So I have all these wonderful other writers that I work with, and we share work with each other and we give each other feedback and we help each other grow. And sometimes I'll collaborate with someone on a musical, and sometimes I'll write it by myself. But I do think it's that old expression, writing is rewriting. Yeah.
I am very familiar with that.
I'm
concept.
Sure you are. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm usually under a deadline where my writing has to just go. I put it out in the world after just a couple of rewrites. But anyway, Chosen Ones. Okay, so it starts August 28th and runs through September 6th. And this is the first time that it's being fully mounted as a musical. Like, basically, this is the first production of it, full scale.
Yes, this is the first full production of it. In fact, this is the first musical of mine, a full-length musical, that's gotten a full professional production. I've had a musical film, Bully, that was very successful in the film festival circuit for a couple of years. I've had shorter works done, I've had plays done, things like that, but this is the first time a full-length musical of mine is actually being performed in a professional capacity, which is very exciting.
Are there any plans after this? Like, if this goes well, what would you like to see happen to the Chosen Ones?
Yeah, I would like to start trying to market it to other theaters around the country. Obviously, dreams of going to things like Broadway or the West End are always, I think, anyone who writes musicals that doesn't admit they want that is lying a little bit. But, you know, it's for most shows, that is kind of a dream. But this is a small show. I think it could do really well off Broadway. I think it could really do well in the regional theater circuit. I think it's really relevant right now, actually more relevant than when I wrote it. It's getting worse, not better, for LGBTQ plus people in the U.S. right now, as I think we know. And I think this is becoming more relevant and more painfully necessary as time goes on. And I do hope, I think that shows have the ability to soften people's hearts in a way that debate and policy and activism sometimes can't, because it's not an issue. It's a story. It's a group of people. It's a group of people that you really care to love, come to love and care about in a short amount of time. I think about shows like La Cage aux Folles being done in the 80s, you know, and just how, despite the incredible homophobia at the time and all of the fear around the AIDS epidemic, people still came to the theater and fell in love with those characters and came to care. And I hope that a show like this has the potential to do that too. I tried not to make it too preachy. I tried to, you know, really have these characters exist authentically in this world and see what that looks like. And I have kind of like an allergy to two-dimensional villains in my work in general. I think most people that are villains are really just people who believe what they're doing is right, and they're doing some really painful and horrible and terrible things. You know, I don't think that a lot of people go out in there in the world just rubbing their hands together and saying, you know, I can't wait to commit evil. You know, and that's kind of what happens here. Like, the conversion therapy camp is doing some real harm, but these are people who are loving and caring, and they think they're doing good in the world, and they want to do right by these kids, and they care about these kids. That doesn't preclude them from doing some real harm.
Mm. You know, I remember when Exodus actually imploded, yeah, and the head of that actually went away with his husband and moved here to Texas. I have no idea how that happened. And I thought that was the end of this kind of thing. And I was really surprised to find out that conversion therapy is alive and well. I'm sure it is thriving in this era. I'm sure it is now aimed where it used to be aimed at the gay community. I'm sure now it is horrifically aimed at the trans community. So specifically, to lump them in there with that, which has to be even more scarring to, you know, just your whole identity, just completely, and your gender and your concept of who you are being attacked by something like this. So it is an interesting topic, and it is unfortunately relevant to today, which I'm surprised, because I really kind of felt like we were past all of this. But
that's part of the reason why I wanted to write this, because I think a lot of us felt that way. All that happened is visibility decreased. And that also means that a lot of these organizations are operating with some really scary people and some really scary shadows. And it's happening all across the country, and not just in the US too. There's a big movement in the UK against this right now. In 2021, there was a new documentary that came out about this called Pray Away. And, you know, and I've even just working on this project, when people found out what it was about, I've had so many people say to me, I went through that. And some of them are very young, and it's still very much happening, and it's still shocking. But yeah, so I think a lot of these things sort of went underground a little bit more, but they're still there. And underground is a scarier place for them to be because there are no real qualifications. There are no certifications. There's nothing, there's no organization looking over organizations like this and making sure that they're not just abusing children, even if you think conversion therapy isn't in itself abuse. And there's some scary stuff going on.
Well, it's really a misnomer because it's not therapy and it's not accredited by any kind of psychological or psychiatric thing. It's religion. I mean, let's call it what it is. It's religion and it's indoctrination. And it is absolutely kind of one-sided on that. And that is how they've couched it. That's how they've been able to be out there. And that's the way that they continue to kind of do that. Is as long as they're supported by that, then they're going to be out there. So it is a very timely musical. And I can't wait to see what you've done with it and how you kind of created songs around it and experiences and developing these relationship with these kids. And then you talk about the villain, which I'm assuming is the pastor or the person that runs it and things like that. So it'll be a great experience to witness The Chosen Ones and kind of figure out that it's still relevant to our time. Oof.
Yeah. I wish it were not, but I do hope that this helps people learn more about it, talk about it, really think more deeply about it. Hoping with increased awareness, there can be increasing things like oversight and state bans and stuff like that. Like the scientific consensus is absolutely not in favor of this. There are versions of it that look more scientific that are done by psychologists and psychiatrists and that have other types of names. There's actually an about section of the musical's webpage, thechosenonesmusical.com/about, and it includes a whole section on conversion therapy with some links and some more information about the different ways that you might see this referred to. But yeah, I mean, there are all different versions of this, but none of them are supported by the major psychological and psychiatric organizations. The scientific consensus is firmly against it.
And if you want more information, thechosenonesmusical.com is where we can find the about the musical, a deep dive into that. Of course, thunderclapproductions.com is the theater group that is producing it. Ironically, you have a heavy hand in both, so
yes.
We'll find out about that. And of course, starts its run August 28th, goes through September 6th, so, and it will be at the Match Theater, so. Thank you so much, Aaron. I always find you fascinating. I really love Thunderclap. I really love getting to see your work. This is going to be an exciting part of my summer and definitely something that I've been looking forward to seeing for a while. So congratulations.
Thank you. I'll throw one last thing out there. If anyone listening to this wants to use the discount code PRIDE20, you can get general admission tickets for $20 with that code.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And opening night is, as always with Thunderclap, we try to make it pay what you can so you can get in for any amount you can afford.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's always a great structure to do that. But I will see you then, probably.
See you then. So. Thank you so much, Brett.
Thank you.
So hello, everyone. My name is Jacob Newsom with Power of the Narrative, and we are co-hosting this episode with KPFT Queer Voices. I have a very special guest. His name is Wayne Chella. He's a director of the films Insignificant, Talisman, forgot about that one, and Mercury. A lot of it is based on Wayne Chella's life. And so, Wayne, would you like to tell the audience more about yourself and the works that you've produced?
Yeah, sure. So I started writing at a pretty young age. I can remember as far back as like 8 or 9 with my friend up the street. We were writing like little plays that we would put together and put on. And then as I got older, that kind of grew. And then at 15, I wrote like a murder mystery novel with a good friend of mine. And then around the time I was like 18, around the time depicted in the film Mercury, I started to get into filmmaking and specifically filmmaking with that group of friends that's depicted in that film. Those friendships met an acrimonious ending. And so I really didn't do much for a long time. And then I guess in my early 20s, I started writing again, kind of got the bug. And, yeah, so the results are, as you mentioned, Talisman, Insignificant, and Mercury. So, yeah.
Which I love By the way, I love all the, so I'm biased because I love all the films. But, you know, I'm curious too, like, why did you go from writing physically to filmmaking? Because you could have just stayed as like an author, published a bunch of books. So I'm curious about why you felt like that's where your process needed to evolve.
I don't know that I really can answer that. I was visually, I've always been a film buff, always really enjoyed watching television shows. And then eventually got to a point, like I said, you know, when we made Talisman, I had written that script. I have a writing, and I know I'm talking about a previous work, but it connects. So when we were shooting Talisman, we originally shot that as a short film just to see how it was going to go. Listen, the actors had so much chemistry together, Colin included in that, that we weren't even finished shooting a short film, and we had already decided we would spin that off into a web series. So we shot the short film in 2018. We shot the rest of the series in 2019. And in between, on Valentine's Day, 2019, I woke up just like any other morning, grabbed my phone, which is unfortunately not uncommon, and just kind of like checked in to see what the world was up to, right? And there was a news article from a local television station in Philadelphia talking about clergy sexual abuse. And that was a game changer for me, mainly because I had avoided all of that stuff for a very long time.
Yeah.
So anyway, I read the article. It kind of shook me up a little bit. There was a list of credibly accused clergy that had been investigated and again, credibly accused. I opened that list and I started scrolling, and I knew that that person's name would be on the list. And sure enough, it was. And it was right about at that moment that my husband walked out of the bathroom and into our bedroom, having just gotten out of the shower, he's getting ready for work. And I guess I'm pretty pale, but I was probably white as a sheet at that point.
Okay.
And immediately he was like, you know, what's wrong? And I had mentioned something, but that's what I used to do. If I was close to people, I would hint at or even in some cases, like joke about what had happened to me. That day, it just didn't feel like a joke anymore. And I went to work and I had to stand in front of like 100 people at work and give a presentation. And as soon as I was done, like everything just washed over me. I went and I talked to a couple of really close friends. You know, one of them was like, hey, you should probably go talk to somebody. And I did. But so it was in between this process of making Talisman that this all kind of comes to light. You know, unfortunately with trauma, you don't have all the pieces sometimes. And yeah, that was certainly the case for me. Was I knew that I had all of these experiences that had happened to me over the course of my lifetime, a bunch of which didn't really make a lot of sense to me. And unfortunately that day, you know, I went to work and I was like, Was I sexually abused or assaulted? Is that what happened? And I looked it up and I read about it and I was like, this is me. They're talking about me. And for whatever reason, it put into perspective some of the things that had happened to me over the span of time. Immediately, I knew that I needed to share that story, because if that can happen to me, it can happen to anybody.
Yes.
I am fairly lucky in the sense that despite the trauma and the things that happened to me in the past, that I was able to overcome that and be reasonably successful. And I felt like, you know, it was just very important to me to share that so that people understood that they weren't alone. So I immediately started writing Insignificant. And again, you know, we were in the process of filming Talisman. Colin and I had gotten really close, just because Colin is one of the most creative people I know. And so we just clicked on that level. And so he would bounce ideas off of me. I would bounce ideas off of him and vice versa. And I got pretty deep into writing the series. And I was like, I need to talk to somebody about this. And so I sent it to Colin and he read it. And I kind of like waited as he read, wondering what he was going to think of it. And he came back and he was like, we need to make this now. And I was like, well, it's not going to be now, but you think it's good. And he was like, yeah, we need to tell the story. The story needs to be told. And that's kind of how that kind of came about. So yes, it was very important for me to get that story out into the world. And then, you know, we casted it, we filmed it, and then I'm putting it together. And right before we're about to release it into the world, there was like this overwhelming sense of dread, because I had basically told my story, beat by beat retelling of my story, but it is deeply grounded in my personal truth, in my experience. The names are changed, the circumstances may be a little bit different, but that is pretty much my life. And so, yeah, there was this moment of panic where it was like, do I really want to put this personal story out into the world? And I panicked for a couple of days, and then, you know, remembered why I had done it in the first place, which was to help people and to, like I said, let them know that they're not alone.
Thank you. I hear you. I'm holding space for your story here.
Thank you. And that means a lot. It really does. It really does. Again, obviously, having had somewhat similar experiences, you understand the stigma and the things that we feel, I think, as you come to terms with those types of issues. And I think that was the hard part for me. I remember, and I guess it's not a funny story, but it's a funny story.
I mean,
my friend, like I said, he was like, you should probably talk to somebody. And I said, yeah, I agree. And then the person that I reached out to talk to, I had seen 27 years before, but I was a kid and was hyper aware of the fact that my parents were involved in that. And, you know, as a 16, 17 year old kid, you don't think about, hey, there are HIPAA rules and things like that, that you have privacy, but I didn't know that. And so I did not talk about those things. I talked about other things that bothered me, but I did not mention my sexual orientation. And I certainly didn't mention anything that had happened to me. And so 27 years later, faced with that, I called, and sure enough, he was still in practice. And we'd always had a really good rapport, and I really liked him. I just wasn't honest with him. And so sure enough, I reached out and he called me back a little later, and I could hear the smile over the phone. You know, he remembered me, and he said, hey, what's going on? And I said, listen, you know, I just kind of rediscovered this issue that happened. It was the reason that I was seeing you 27 years ago, but I couldn't be honest about it. And now I need to be. And so, yeah, it was just this whole experience really brought a lot of things full circle for me, that being one of them, relation.
So I'm sensing a lot of themes of like maturity and also like lessons of receiving that you're still working through to this day, of like receiving goodness, receiving all these things. Does this sound like about right for you?
It sounds spot on. It even when it comes to the work itself, you know, Insignificant in particular really seemed to resonate with people. It won a lot of awards. We played a lot of festivals. You know, it by all accounts was successful, not the financial way, but ultimately it accomplished what I wanted it to accomplish, which was it got out there. People saw it and they were affected by it. And I think as a creator, that's what you look for. You're trying to tell a story that moves people in some way, right? Sometimes that way is just to entertain them.
Yes.
But sometimes it's to make them feel something deeply. And I think it did that.
If I can ask too, what does the legacy of your work look like, and how do you envision the impact to be that would satisfy you?
I guess I would have to say what I said originally, which is if one person saw Insignificant and perhaps saw a little bit of themselves in Wes or even in Anthony, those characters who were clearly both struggling in different ways, and they realize that they're not alone, or they see, you know, that Wes suffered abuse and realize that they're not alone. If one person is impacted positively by any of that, or even Mercury for that matter, then that's the legacy that, you know, that would be amazing to me. So.
Because you answered a lot of these, because it was like, was there a moment in making either Insignificant or Mercury on the set during writing or editing where the emotional weight of the work became undeniable?
I will tell you. Yeah, so it's funny when we shot Insignificant, it's this really weighty story, right?
Yes.
But it was this joyous experience. And I really mean that. Overwhelmingly positive. The actors who appeared in Insignificant were just amazing people who really took that story to heart and really wanted to bring it to life. And really, it was like I had partners in that, you know? A lot of times when you make a film, people are excited about the story you're telling, or they're excited about the opportunity they got.
Yes.
But these folks really were excited to put something out into the world that could make a positive impact and help people, right? Even an insignificant, you know, Izzy, the female lead, is struggling with an eating disorder. And that was something that was just, it was so important to her as an actress to put that out into the world and bring light to it. But so we had this joyous experience. It literally, we became a family on set. Everybody still keeps in touch to this day. But the last shot of Insignificant is actually just, it was part of a montage at the beginning of Insignificant, which is of Wes's parents fighting. Yes. And that was the final thing we shot. And we did three takes. And each, it was like reliving my childhood, because my parents, that is my experience. My parents did divorce. They were not a great match, right? There was a lot of domestic violence in my home. And yeah, so anyway, by the third take of that scene where the mother kind of like charges at the father and like is screaming at him, and he clears all the things off of the countertop and everything goes smashing, I called cut and I disappeared because I just broke down. It was really emotional. It was very heavy, and I will never forget one. And Keith Pichardo, who played Miles, yeah, they came and they found me, and I was just crying. I was done, and they just came. There were no words even spoken, and the two of them just hugged me and just stayed that way for a few minutes. And you know, finally, I got myself together. But yeah, it was very emotionally heavy, and it was heavy filming it. It was heavy writing it, because writing it required me to go back and sort of relive, you know, those experiences that were not all that pleasant. You know, Insignificant is not just about the fact that Wes, you know, survived sexual assault or sexual abuse. It's also about what it was like growing up in the 90s as a gay kid
Yes.
who went to an all boys school, who had all of these things that were seemingly working against him that made it difficult. And ultimately, yeah, it was a very heavy period, a very heavy couple of years, but ultimately it wound up being like therapy.
I was going
Because
to ask you that.
sometimes when you walk through that dark stuff, when you're done walking through it and reliving it, you get to the light, right? And you feel lighter because you have now dealt with that and sort of let it go. And releasing Insignificant into the world was my final act of letting go, I think.
I want to ask you too. I'm not going to assume. Have you done inner child work before?
I have not.
Okay. So I ask a lot of guests this, and I even do this for myself. What would you, knowing what you know now, what would you go back and say to like young Wayne?
I think the best advice that I could give myself if I was younger, to give yourself a break, because I didn't do that. I was very serious. Even from the time that I was a child, I was very serious. I didn't smile a lot. And it's weird. It's like this dichotomy, because I'm a very lighthearted person. I love to laugh. I love to smile. And I believe at my core there's a lightheartedness to me, but the expression of that never came through. It was very much heavy for me as a child. And yeah, I think I would tell young Wayne to give himself a break and to not take everything so seriously. You have to have fun, and you have to see the joy, and you have to let people in, like we talked about earlier.
Yes.
And that's not who he was. It just wasn't, you know. So yeah, I think that would be my advice.
Sounds like there's a lot weighing down his spirit. What would you want somebody who sees your work, especially somebody that's queer, isolated, cut off from a lot of the friendship, what would you want them to take away from their work and believe about themselves?
Be your own person. Do it your way. There's no right way. You know, everyone is walking through this life. Everyone has their own challenges and their own obstacles. Be yourself and find your own way, because listening to people's advice and them telling you how to live your life, or none of that matters, man. None of it matters. The most important piece is to be able to look in the mirror and be proud of who that person is. And
Mel
Peterson. That goes for everybody, not just queer people, anybody. You have to be able to look yourself in the mirror and be okay with that person. And I am fortunate because of these experiences that I got to a place where now I kind of agree with people. I'm not going to say I'm a great guy, but I like that person. I do think that that person that I see in the mirror has really good intentions and wants to help people, whether that's through narrative or that's through, you know, being a presence in their lives or trying to mentor people, whatever that looks like. I always want to leave something better than I found it. That's my philosophy. So, you know, be okay with who you are. And regardless of people who may try to put you down or try to make you feel bad about that, don't listen to that crap, because it's crap. It really is, you know, and find your way. Surround yourself with people that you love, that will love you. That is called chosen family. Sometimes, unfortunately, that's not blood family, and that's okay. I'm fortunate. My blood family is still in my life. I didn't lose anybody because of coming out or anything like that. But the people that I hold dearest are my chosen family. Those are the people I want to be around. I've just been amazingly fortunate to encounter the people that I have. And the one thing I guess I would say is there is something to learn from everybody that crosses your path. Sometimes those things are what not to do, or sometimes those are things that you might want to emulate and incorporate into your own story. But I've just been blessed. And, you know, that goes for Colin. It goes for my writing partner. It goes for all of the actors who helped me bring these stories to life, and all of the folks behind the scenes that did. Aaron's daughter is my co-director on Insignificant.
That's so cool.
So you talk about full circle moments, right?
Yes.
When I started talking about, you know, getting back into filmmaking, Aaron was like, hey, you know, Asha has this experience. And I was like, okay. And so she came and she helped us. And it's just, like I said, there's something positive that can be taken from every interaction that you have with somebody. And, you know, do that. Look at the light in the world. There is so much darkness. We hear about it constantly. It's in the news. It is everywhere. And it's real, and it is legitimate. But there are still so many beautiful things in this world, and so many amazing people, and so many amazing stories that don't get that focus from the media, that are out there waiting to be told and discovered. And yeah, go out and follow your dreams and tell your story, because everybody has a story.
Thank you, Wayne. This has been Power of the Narrative with Jacob Newsom, guest star Wayne. Please go check out Mercury Insignificant, Talisman. And I would love to have you on for future episodes, because this has been incredible.
Anytime.
This has been Queer Voices, heard on KPFT Houston and as a podcast available from several podcasting sources. Check our webpage, queervoices.org, for more information. Queer Voices executive producer is Brian Levinka. Deborah Moncrief Bell is co-producer. Brett Cullum, Davis Mendoza Druzman, and
Ethan Michelle Gans
are contributors. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
The man Winston Churchill called Scotland's greatest ambassador. You're on The Soundbeat.
I've seen lots of bonnie laddies on
my travels wide. But my heart is centered new on Bonnie Kate McBride.
Sir Harry Lauder was one of the biggest stars of the early 20th century. In 1911, when he released the hugely popular Roman in the Gloamin', he was the highest paid performer in the world.
Roman in the Gloamin', on the bonny banks of Clyde. Roman in the Gloamin', with my lassie by my side.
He was well loved in his native Scotland for his support of troops during World War I, including fundraising and performances, one of which found him under enemy fire. For all these efforts, Lauder was knighted by King George V in 1919.